research for Betty Fussell's latest book, which is A Look at America's Most Iconic Food, took her far beyond the library. She rode in costume in a rodeo parade. She suited up to learn firsthand the art of butchering and trailed a buyer for Peter Lugers through the Gansevoort meat market, all to get to the bottom of America's love affair with beef. Raising Steaks, The Life and Times of American Beef is published by Harcourt Books, and I'm pleased that it brings Betty Fussell back to the show. Hi, Betty.
Hi, Leonard. Thank you for having me.
Now, your last book was on the history of corn in this country, and corn and beef have been intertwined in recent years. Is that what got you from one to the other?
They've been intertwined for as long as beef has been here, almost.
Oh, I thought the cattle used to graze on grass.
They did, but they're intertwined in the sense that corn is the foundation of all the civilizations in the New World, including the United States when it got going. So they haven't been as closely connected as they have recently since World War II. But yes, they are they're intimate.
You write in the beginning of your book, "Geography is destiny." How does that apply to beef?
Space. We are huge, and cattle require space. They are not like dairy cattle. They're not like the mixed agriculture that England established here is very unlike the ranching culture that Spain established here. We have these two countries, New Spain and New England. One is pastoral and one is desert.
And they both brought over cattle. But the cows that we eat, are they from the Spanish tradition, or are they from the British tradition, or from some other tradition?
They're exactly mixed. They're a mixture of the criollo, which the Spanish brought, and the shorthorn, which the British brought. So everything about beef is hybrid the way America is.
Statistically, where does the beef market fit into the agricultural industry? How much income does it generate?
It's the largest single agricultural commodity in terms of revenue. So it's, about a $90 billion a year industry? No, essential to our economy and certainly to our trade policies, vital.
So how much of it do we eat and how much do we export?
We are the largest producers of corn-fed cattle in the world. So domestically, we are not the largest consumer. We eat about 68 pounds of beef per person per year as an average, but Argentina outdoes us.
Well, they produce a lot of cattle themselves.
And it's all grass-fed, but domestically they're the only country that eats more beef than we do.
And do we eat more beef in certain parts of the country than others? Are certain ethnic groups more likely to eat it than others? Income levels?
It depends. When you talk about steak is different from hamburger. So about 59% of the beef that is eaten in our country is hamburger. Therefore, steak is about 22%. And the group that eats the most of that is white males. The black population eats a lot of beef, but it's more fast food.
You talk about the romance of beef. What's that? And how close is it to the reality of the situation?
We live and eat by romance. We're a romantic country. And in steak, for me, two romances come together. The romance of the cowboy and the West, and the romance of the machine. And one is Western, essentially, and one is Eastern. And they came together when the cowboys hit the railroads, 1867, in the first cow town, Abilene, Kansas. And so this gives us a century and a half of industrialized beef.
And you spent a lot of time in Texas, Colorado, and Kansas, but it actually begins and ends in New York City. And people would not think a book on beef would begin and end in New York City, although this is where you live. But I was always surprised when I went into restaurants in the West and saw New York strip steak featured on the menu. So is New York important in the romance of beef for people in other parts of the country?
I think New York is not identified with slaughterhouses the way it should be historically, because it was fifth in the nation until World War II.
The UN is built over a major abattoir, isn't it?
Exactly. The UN building on the East River is built where the abattoirs were. And on the west side, on the Hudson, the what remains of the Gansevoort Market was a major slaughterhouse, slaughterhouse area. And cows would be shipped in from New Jersey across, as soon as the Pennsylvania Railroad got going here. So until World War II, this was a major slaughterhouse area.
The meatpacking district now is mostly a place of boutiques and fancy restaurants.
Have we
pretty much gotten out of the meat business?
We've just shifted it, but as we've shifted it in the way that, you know, people, how many people have seen a cow slaughtered in New York? Okay, major shift. That's extremely important to the industrialization of beef. When we remove the raising of cattle, the processing of cattle, the marketing of cattle, and where the consumer actually gets it, all those have been fractured.
You learned about a secret cow tunnel under 12th Avenue. Is it still in existence?
I haven't found it. I keep looking. But what people can see is the remains of the High Line.
Which is now being made into a park.
Right. But that was put in as recently as the 1930s because the freight traffic of the cows to these slaughter processing houses in the market, in Gansevoort Market, were so numerous that people got killed there all the time. It was called Death Avenue. 10th Avenue was Death Avenue. And they had guys on horseback with red flags, which they called the West Side Cowboys. Still, there were so many deaths that they said, hey, we got to raise and have it elevated tracks.
I've always wondered about slaughter on 10th Avenue. That actually is related to this.
You said it.
Well, one of the things that I have noticed over the years, over my lifetime, is the fact that so many of the great butcher shops have disappeared in New York. Were they linked to the fact that we had a different kind of a meat industry in the past?
Absolutely, because the butcher shops went with local slaughterhouses. Now, if the slaughterhouses have disappeared just the way the family farm has disappeared, there are very few, and all the industry is concentrated in the big four. The big four packing houses and marketers are the same thing. So the meat's all cryovacked and shipped out like shoes.
And you cite 1867 as the beginning of the end of urban livestock markets in the East.
Because that's when the first railroad crossed in Abilene. And there were other places like Dodge City, you know, the cow towns that became famous because that's where the end of the cowboy drives would be and they would, you know, make hell.
My guest is Betty Fussell, whose latest book is called Raising Steaks, The Life and Times of American Beef. It's published by Harcourt. You say that the King Ranch in Texas epitomizes what has happened to Texas cattle ranching. What's happened at the King Ranch?
Texas is really interesting because all along the border are the oldest continuous cattle ranches in the United States because cows first came up from Mexico after 1521. And they have they were mixed families of Irishmen and who married the daughters who had inherited the Spanish land grant. King was one of those. And King was an Irish entrepreneur who made money during the Civil War. So he was very typical of the kind of, again, a racial mixture and a cultural mixture that first developed Texas cattle ranches. Then what happened to King's ranch, and he did it Spanish style. They were King's people. He brought whole villages up from Mexico. Is that in this century, I mean, this, and within the last 40 years, it has become corporatized and is now a Disneyland. It's just a theme park.
So they're not raising cattle there anymore?
They raise a little show herd, but they are diversified into numbers of other many, many products. And it's just there. It's just preserved. It's a kind of historical museum.
Wasn't much of the cattle territory also where oil was found in Texas?
Oil has subsidized the Texas ranch, as the ranchers well know and as they speak of.
Did it keep beef prices down?
Not enough. It didn't help them enough. As they all say, no single rancher can make a living on cattle. You have to be subsidized by something. But not even the oil is enough. All these guys have gone into game. They've gone into deer hunting farms, wild game that they import.
So where are the cattle being raised these days?
They're being raised in large clumps, mostly, of 100,000 in a feedlot. in the middle states of Kansas, Nebraska.
So they're in feedlots. They're not roaming the plains as they did in Rio Bravo and all of those great westerns.
Well, there are two stages. One, there are 100,000 ranchers listed, but most of those have herds under 50, and a lot of them have herds under 10. So they don't count. Most of those, the largest percentage, are raised by the feedlots, which are raised by the packers.
You visited a family farm in Vermont. How many cattle would they have?
Now, they were trying to do it the old way, sustainable, and so they would have about a dozen cows. But, of course, the whole problem is slaughtering. They've had to put a lot of money into a local slaughterhouse for the cattle, which in effect is not cost-effective. Therefore, it's the slaughterhouse is a big obstacle to making local farms.
Aren't they also hurt by government regulation, which is really designed for the big cattle ranchers?
It's designed entirely, and that is the big block. It's the actually building the slaughterhouse itself has to be to specs that fit only large corporations.
Michael Pollan was recently on the show to talk about his article on the future of food policy in the New York Times magazine a couple of weeks back. In an open letter to the next president, he also called for more support for smaller slaughter facilities. Do you think that we're likely to see any change?
Since the USDA has a revolving door with the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, which is the trade organization to promote beef, no, this is a hard, hard road because it's very interlined.
Michael Pollan also says that we eat too much meat. Should we cut back on our consumption of red meat for health reasons?
Well, we eat too much of everything. You know, that's why we have an obesity problem. We're into quantity food because we're into cheap food. The moment you start putting other values, you stop thinking cheap, then you stop thinking quantity.
The beef industry has also been hurt by rumors around the world that our beef isn't safe. And we've had a couple of serious scandals. Has lax government inspection been a problem?
We don't really have government inspection. I mean, who do we have? The USDA was designed to promote beef in 1867. That's been its job. The FDA did not come into being until after Upton Sinclair's scandal, this book about the jungle, about the stockhouses in Chicago. But in fact, it's a bifurcated responsibility and nobody's safe, no.
Because to some degree, the plants actually just regulate themselves. They provide their own inspectors.
They provide their own inspectors, and it's voluntary recall. It doesn't matter whether it's all the people who were killed by Jack in the Box hamburgers. There was still voluntary recall.
But they're not concerned about the fact that hurts their image and
hurting their
people.
Image, hurting their image is all they're concerned about. But their tactic has been then to repropagandize.
Didn't you tour the Cargill plant in Kansas? What did they tell you about all of that?
They gave me a brilliant show, and I was fascinated by it because it looked like Charlie Chaplin's, you know, Modern Times. It is so mechanized. It's kind of dazzling. But I certainly wasn't allowed to see the rendering plant right behind, the invisible industry. Where does all the waste go? Important question.
You end the book with a diagram of the cow and beef recipes. You wanted to leave us with something positive?
Oh, absolutely. I adore beef. And I rediscovered that I could eat steak tartare now that we have Wagyu, which is like beef butter, which we're growing here, a Japanese breed, which is Americanized.
But it's incredibly expensive. In fact, beef, any decent beef, is very expensive these days. You think the current economic situation is going to hurt the industry even more?
It'll hurt the industry, but it'll improve, I think, our consumption of beef by looking for quality and not for cheap.
And that's what you would recommend? Buy the good stuff.
Buy only the good stuff, as you would anything. Buy less, buy good.
Is buying local a good way to do it? Because I remember a restaurateur telling me that he was going to buy only Amish beef, and then he had to back off because it was tougher than the stuff you get from the regular restaurant suppliers.
Yes, local is a problem. Well, we can't grow beef in Manhattan, can we? We can't raise them on Central Park, so there's always going to be a problem of distribution with something as big as a cow. There are two beef guys at the Green Square Market, and that counts as local. And those will develop as slaughterhouses develop. The advantage with local is that you know how the beef is being taken care of, the cows are being taken care of.
Should we try to get beef that's only been raised on grass?
I'm not a purist on the grass-fed. It's okay for me if they finish off with some a certain measure of corn. It's the idea of force-feeding them corn as for a few months, and when they almost double their weight, that ruins their system. That brings on all the health problems and the hormones and the rest of the things we don't want.
Does it affect the taste of the meat?
Of course it does. And if you have grass-fed, I far prefer it because it has a beefier taste, but that's the beef I grew up on.
Betty Fussell is the author of 10 previous books, including The Story of Corn and My Kitchen War. She's a contributor to The New York Times, The New Yorker, Sever, Food and Wine, Gastronomica, and other publications. And her latest book is Raising Steaks, The Life and Times of American Beef, published by Harcourt. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Thank you very much, Leonard.